The content of this podcast should not be considered financial or investment advice. All interviews and discussions are opinions only, and the podcast has been created without taking into consideration the listener's financial objectives, financial situation, or needs. Listeners should obtain independent advice before making any financial decisions. The Explorers podcast is sponsored by RM Capital, a provider of specialist small to mid-cap corporate advisory and boutique wealth management services. G'day, this is Barry Fitzgerald, Garen Pirro columnist for Stockhead. Welcome to another edition of the Explorers podcast. Now today we have Silver Mines with us. The code is SVL, trading at 16.75 cents for a market cap of just under 248 million. And that gives you a clue that the company's got something significant under its belt already. And I must say, being on the Explorers podcast is a bit of a misnomer because Silver Mines is very much on the pathway to production from its Bowdens silver and base metals project in central New South Wales, about 25 clicks east of Mudgee. Now, to bring us up to speed with the project and what Silver Mines is up to and its plans, and obviously a bit on the silver market itself, we have the relatively new MD with us today, Joe Barishaw. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Barry. It's good to be on here.
Joe, just for those, you're obviously well known in mining circles, but just for those who may not be aware of what your background is, you joined in January this year. Everyone was obviously knew the story well. Tony McClure, the previous MD, told a great story from 2016 on, but he's decided to retire from the position. And it's all yours now. So give us a bit of a feel for your background.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a mine geologist originally, graduated from the Camborne School of Mines in the UK. Pretty much came to Australia straight away and into Western Australia and WMC. So I did a best part of a decade with WMC, predominantly in the nickel business. I finished off there as running sort of business development for the nickel business unit and was part of the team that sold all the mines around Cambowda. So that then gave me a bit of an introduction to all of the brokers and the bankers in Australia, and I made the move over into the finance side. So then spent best part of 15 years with started at Hartleys, then Citigroup, and then a decade at UBS before extracting myself from the banking scene in 2017 and getting back into the mining game. Trying to get my hands dirty. So, I've been on the board of Silver Mines for about 5 years. So making the move into the executive role was not a difficult task for me, and obviously very familiar with what was going on under the bonnet.
Now, I've mentioned Bowdens, a well-known project there near Mudgee. Resource just under 400 million ounces. Now, that is on a silver equivalent basis, and that tells us that there's also zinc and lead, and as you get deeper, apparently there's some copper perhaps, and over to the south you might even, well, you do have some gold. So it's in volcanic rock, so there's obviously a lot of cooking gone on over the years, but now we're looking very much at the development phase. How many ounces do you need? I know there's lots of exploration upside, but let's dig into the development plans to get this thing into production.
Yeah.
First run through. Finally, you've cleared all those hurdles in New South Wales regulatory process. You had a victory there earlier this month. So tell us where you're at now in terms of development approvals to proceed.
Yeah, sure. So, and obviously, look, I mean, we're very relieved and you know, believe that the right decision was made with that the dismissing of the judicial review. I mean, one thing I would say is that the New South Wales permitting process is it's a very difficult one, and it'd be one of the most difficult in the world. But everything my predecessor Tony did and the team was through the correct protocols, and the process was adhered to, and it was very rigid and strict in terms of everything was done. So we weren't surprised to see that judicial review dismissed, but a bit of a relief nonetheless. So where we're at now that the judicial review has been dismissed, the application is now with Tanya Plibersek's group, and we're aiming to get the federal reviews for the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation. That clock started just a couple of weeks ago, and so we would expect to have that sort of between, you know, somewhere between end of May and sort of mid-June, hopefully. Once we get that approval, I mean, assuming we get that approval, and I don't see why we shouldn't, based on the work done to date, that then flicks back to the State Department for essentially rubber stamping on the granting of the mining license, and from that point, it's then good to go. So look, I mean, in terms of the permitting, and again back to Tony, you know, he originally joined the company and said, oh, you know, he'd stick around for 2 to 3 years to get through the feasibility study and the permitting, and you know, 6 years later he resigned after or retired, for want of a better word, after getting the IPC. So it's been a long, laborious and very time consuming process. On the actual development front itself, I mean, with all this going on in the foreground, in the background, you know, we've got a team of 30 people on site, including a very experienced general manager who's built a few operations around the world. They are running an optimization process, or DFS effectively. Bear in mind, we completed the bankable feasibility study back in 2018, which was the trigger to start the state permitting process. Subsequent to that, because that process has taken so long, we've drilled another 55,000 meters of drilling within the Bowdens deposit. You know, extended the resources. In fact, the resource was upgraded by 56% last year to get us that close to 400 million ounces. In terms of resource, it's about 50-50 silver base metals. You know, we're talking about a project here that is a very, very large, vast system of mineralization. Yeah, the background rocks within the district is sort of average about 6 grams silver per ton, and what we've got here is obviously a much higher grade portion of that larger system at the edge of a collapsed caldera. So you know that there's a lot of exploration potential around the remainder of that caldera, which we haven't even looked at yet. We haven't really started. When we look at the reserve component, the reserve is 100 million ounces. So it's a relatively low resource to reserve conversion ratio, which is not a surprise given some of the grade of the peripheral material. But importantly, on that reserve, it's about 100 million ounces, of which about 70% is silver. So, you know, from a silver exposure perspective, once up and running, you know, the EBITDA, annual EBITDA is, you know, the exposure to silver is in that 70-75% region. So it's a good silver play. It's a very good silver play with a lot of exploration potential and chance to extend and expand the life.
Given that high silver ratio, people should start thinking. Well, think about it as the zinc and the lead as byproducts, paying to get a super low cost of production on the silver side.
Yeah,
so I think I've seen a figure of possibly less than $10 an ounce. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, in the bankable feasibility study, the first 3 years were around about 6 million ounces of silver at less than $10 US an ounce, all in sustaining costs. So, I mean, they're very competitive. The optimization process is obviously, you know, all of those numbers are going to be recut, and we've told the market that, you know, we're aiming to have those numbers finalized and into the market in sort of July, August this year. Hopefully leading into a financial investment decision later this year. But in terms of the way to think about this mine, and this is where it differs slightly from sort of a gold mine, is that, you know, fundamentally this deposit is a vast deposit of very low grade lead zinc with a lot of silver. And so the process is, you know, we mine it, we crush, we grind, we put it into a flotation plant, and we produce two concentrate streams. And the way the metallurgy works is the bulk of the silver deports to the lead concentrate, and then we have a very small amount of zinc concentrate. And so the high value product here, that lead concentrate is going to be going about between 10,000 and 12,000 grams per ton. So it's going to be very highly sought after by global lead smelters. And that lead silver concentrate generates about 85% of the revenue. So it's a bit, you know, it's and then, but then they're tiny amounts, Barry. You know, we're looking at, you know, 10,000-11,000 tons a year of the lead concentrate. I mean, it's very, very small amounts.
So silver, investors in silver stocks and the physical, They talk about gold bugs. There's some real silver bugs out there too. But so this market does this future operation does qualify under that silver bug sort of. I want silver. That's my pure focus because you've got this high silver revenue count. Okay. All right. So you mentioned a possible FID at the end of the year, towards the end of the year. If four comes to pass, when could you be in first production?
Well, obviously, you know, going into an FID, you then have the financing or the challenges that go with financing. You know, we're a pretty conservative bunch in terms of our board and putting shareholders at risk. We wouldn't be looking to have excessive gearing on this. So, I mean, the capital profile of the feasibility study was about $246 million Aussie. We've been quite open about where we think that will land with the definitive feasibility study is, potentially in that 300 to 330, 340 kind of range. We wouldn't look to do more than sort of 220 of debt onto that. So we'd be relatively conservative in terms of the financing structure. But obviously that takes a few months to put in place. Once the financing is in place, the build time is 18 months, Barry. So, it's a fairly conventional crush, grind, float type of operation. I mean, yeah, from a pre-strip perspective on the mining front, I mean, this ore body in the feasibility study, the strip ratio is 1.6 to 1. We're running scenarios now where we can see that strip ratio reduce even further. So a lot of this ore body actually daylights. We're mining high grade material from day one effectively. So that's obviously very, very beneficial.
And talking about daylighting, I see that you've been taking some bulk samples where you've had some reconciliation figures. What's the story there?
Yeah, look, I mean, interestingly, I mean, and this gets a bit technical, but the way the system has been formed, the collapsible DRE, there's just been a pulse of high energy hot fluids that have come through, and it's created lots of little micro fractures, and the orientation of those fractures is not best to be drilled from surface. So in a way, if we had the ability to, if this was an underground project, Barry, and you're doing grade control drilling, you'd put a fence of horizontal holes in, and you would actually pick up, or we believe you would pick up an additional set of these veins that you don't pick up in some of the drilling we've done. So our view internally is that the resource estimate is relatively conservative in terms of the contained metal. So to see a bulk sample and actually be able to sort of quantify what we believe is going to be more likely from the mining scenario is it was a very positive. Now it's a very, very small bulk sample, Barry. So I mean we're not suggesting by any stretch that the resource is going to see 30-40% more metal in it, but it's just given us a little bit more confidence in terms of how we need to move forward with the resource estimates and then again quite technical, but one of the aspects that we're going to be introducing over the course of the next few months is a domain within the resource looking at sort of fracture intensity, because that's going to be a very good indicator as to where the metal is from a grade control perspective and an operating perspective. So yeah, look, really, really positive to see. I mean, if it had gone the other way, obviously it would have been a bit of a disaster. So we're pretty happy with it.
I was going to mention that in some people's minds, New South Wales and southern Queensland, silver projects in the past have disappointed. What's different about this one?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm currently at a conference. excuse me, I'm currently at a conference up in Singapore, the Tribeca Future Facing Commodities Conference, and that's been mentioned to me a couple of times. And look, my standard response really is that silver mines we're a bit of an orphan on the Australian exchange. Really, I mean, there's not a lot of silver plays. And the reason for that is that, there's a plethora of gold projects, which, the Australian market does incredibly well and understands, unlike any other market in the world, I believe. However, silver is, there's not too many silver deposits in Australia, primary silver deposits. I mean, I would argue that the two largest primary silver deposits that have made money would be Broken Hill and Cannington. I mean, outside of that, there's not been a lot of success. And I think the reason for that is that they've traditionally been very small, run by small companies, which is not a dig at small companies, but yeah, they're usually undercapitalized and trying to get into cash flow as soon as possible. And I've always viewed, you know, mining as a situation where, you know, the geology and the ore body should determine when you get into mining and how big your mine is. And I just feel that some people and some companies just feel they want to make that step into production sooner rather than later. And I think, you know, there's merit to, you know, the Robert Friedland approach, which is just keep drilling. Let's work out how big it is and let's work out a plan. If you're getting good results, you're always going to have, you know, money's always going to be available through the equity markets. And some of these smaller ones have just failed on either lack of metallurgy or understanding of metallurgy or just the resources not small enough. So by the time you've commissioned and, you know, worked through potential issues, you just don't have the mine life to actually return the capital to investors and a return. So where are we different? This is a huge project in terms of silver relative to other projects in Australia. You know, our current reserve is 30 million tons. You know, we're looking at a fairly modest 2 million tons per annum. So we're looking at 15, 16 year mine life. We've had a 56% upgrade to the resource. We're about to go into the optimization of the reserve. You know, do we expect to see an upgrade to the reserve? Yeah, maybe not 56%, but we certainly think we can get this thing to, you know, as an open pit to plus 20 years. And so, if there is any teething issues at the start, which we hope there aren't, but yeah, you've got to sort of allow for some complexities. We've still got time to fix that and really make this thing hum. So that's where we're different, I believe.
So I'll be a bit cheeky and suggest that the torturous New South Wales planning system has given you plenty of time to think about getting this thing right.
I wish that was the reason.
So having said that, I was just wondering, let's look at the broader community. What's their attitude to the project?
Yeah, good question, Barry. I mean, obviously there's a small element of activists which have created quite a lot of noise. And you know, obviously, you know, we've tried to deal with that in the most appropriate manner. But going into the IPC approval process, you know, the state government actually commented to that they'd not seen a mining project in New South Wales going through the application process with so much local support. So, look, I mean, you know, the noise coming out of the action group would probably be just
that noise.
It probably makes it sound like a lot more people are sort of anti the project than is actually the case. I mean, you know, towns like Rylstone and Candos, they need jobs. I mean, they need the investment in the region. So it's not just local landowners that really need to, they should have a say in this. It's the region in general, and really, you know, the IPC process in New South Wales would have to be one of the fairest systems out there now. I mean, it's an independent planning commission. So, I mean, it's hard to really say more than that. I mean, everything we've done through this process has been, you know, the correct protocol. We've done exhaustive studies in terms of, you know, ecosystems for different wildlife, you know, flora and fauna. So, I mean, everything has been done to the required levels and above.
Let's have a look at the silver market. Always interesting. The average price back in 2022 calendar was $22. The average in 23 was $23. And here we are at 24, and it's above $24. So what does it rise a dollar a year? The silver price. But and then you look at it in $8. The increase from last year is it's up to 37.70 as we speak today, up 8%. So there's obviously a bit of a trend there. What do you make of it all?
I'm very bullish silver, and there are silver balls and there are silver nuts, and I'm a silver bull. I'm not a silver nut, but I mean I take a very, very positive view on silver. And again, I'm at this conference in Singapore, And, you know, future facing commodity conference. And I actually, someone came to me yesterday and said, this is a future facing commodity conference. You're a silver company. Why are you here? And so, I mean, I was surprised by that question, to be honest with you. But it was a very enjoyable conversation after that, because I informed this gentleman that, you know, basically silver is in everything electrical we use. I mean, it's, anything that's got an electrical switch in it has got silver in it. You know, there's a scale of electrical conductivity which goes from 0 to 100, and silver is 100. I mean, there is nothing more conductive. 52% of global silver demand goes into industrial applications and photography, and of that, you know, last year was 235 million ounces of silver go into electronics and electrical equipment, excluding electric vehicles and photovoltaics. I mean, the photovoltaic market alone last year was 140 million ounces. Mm. And it's when you start wrapping numbers around the solar industry, it really is quite mind-boggling. And, you know, 1 gigawatt of solar generating capacity requires 3.1 million solar panels. Mm. Now, each solar panel, depending on which technology you're using, will use between 10 and 20 grams per panel. So China last year installed 121 gigawatts of solar panel, of solar capacity. That's about 75, 80 million ounces of silver just for Chinese solar panels.
Mm.
The US, under the IRA Act, you know, the US is targeting 240 gigawatts of solar installations between now and 2028. That's just two countries. I mean, the numbers are really, really quite mind-boggling. And you know, 140, I mean, to put that into context, mine supplies 800 million ounces a year. Solar demand could jump four times between now and 2035. That would be almost all mine supply going into solar panels. Now, that's not going to happen, but it just shows, I mean, because there's thrifting, there's different technologies and what have you, but it just goes to show that, you know, silver is on the cusp of this, you know, massive sort of demand pull from this technology and from the decarbonization of the environment, of the economy, as well as still being, you know, a store of wealth for people. So it's really, I guess, long enough to answer your question, Barry. You know, the silver price has been in a 4-year period of consolidation when you look at it from a technical perspective, and, you know, all of the commentators would suggest it's going to break out of that consolidation period. You look at the charts. It's either going back to 16 or it's going to 35. I don't think it's going to 16.
It's a curious one because it's got the same, you know, poor man's gold, yep. So it's store of wealth. Yet you've got this high growth industrial applications going, and yet the price hasn't taken off yet. But there's good reason to think it could well do so.
I think Barry, you know, there is a very large amount of silver out there. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And you know, when you look at the supply numbers, I mean, it's the last 4 years overall supply has been around about 1 billion ounces. Global demand has been about 1.2. So we're running at sort of 150 to 200 million ounces a year of deficits. So that silver's coming from somewhere. So there's obviously silver out there, and you know. Yeah, there are a lot of cutlery sets built in the you know, the 18th, 19th century and early 20th century that would have been silver. So there's a lot of stuff out there. But within that billion ounces of silver supply every year, 20% of that already comes from recycling. And as we've seen with all commodities, recycling is very price dependent. So as the price goes up, will we see a greater contingent coming in from recycling? Yeah, probably. So it does take a little bit of the edge off. But you know, 70% of silver production comes from, you know, by-production, or is a byproduct credit from lead zinc mines. Now, where's the next major lead zinc mine being built? I can't. You know, there's a real shortfall of new projects on that side. So, the primary silver production is going to become increasingly important, in my view.
So, great fundamentals there, that's for sure. Now, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We could talk about this one forever, but so let's just give investors a feel for what milestones they should look out for. And hopefully, which will lead to re-rating opportunities for the stock.
Yeah, in the short term, you know, we would hope to be getting the environmental approvals through from the federal department. which will lead to the mining license, printing of the mining license. We've got, as part of the optimization studies, we're very close to having a resource update. The resource update is not going to change much. It's based on very few holes, but that will lead into a reserve update. So going into that that completion of the definitive feasibility study between now and July, August, we should be looking at a reserve update, a new print on the reserve prior to that, and then obviously the optimization numbers in July, August. In the background, we've historically not pushed for land access for exploration very aggressively, simply because we wanted to get the mining permits in place. Now a lot of that permitting process is sort of behind us. We're now sort of pushing to get a bit more access into some of these exploration. We've got some incredible exploration targets there, Barry. There's mm-hmm. a project 20 km to the south called Coomba, which was discovered by CRA around the same time as Bowden's. No one's been down there for 12, 13 years, and we see that as a drill out. That's a resource drill out. I mean, it's a lodged discovery with the New South Wales Department. We get access down there. We need to do a bit of geochemistry, a bit of geophysics, just to fine tune it. But then we want to get in there and do a bit of an extensive drill out. So that could be, you're going into a financing and construction commissioning phase, which is usually a bit of a dead period for single asset, single commodity companies. We think we've got a fairly decent set of news flow coming out from exploration.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we've underdone the exploration upside there today, but perhaps for another time. So, Joe, it's a great story. Glad to see that things are progressing well, and look forward to that optimization study. We'll finally be able to put some hard numbers around and start talking some metrics, which would be great. So with that, good luck with it all. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Barry. Much appreciated.